I'm going to speak about things tonight which have to do with halacha. I didn't come over here to teach you halacha. You have rabbanim over here, Baruch Hashem, in this town, that rabbanim chashuvim, rabbanim that know the halacha, and you should be guided by what they tell you. So in case I come out with a halacha tonight, I'm not telling you that it's halacha and you have to follow this. I'm saying, this is what I believe the halacha is. You go and speak to your rabbanim and find out what they're supposed to do, what you're supposed to do. Okay, as Rabbi Chachman said, I'm involved with kashrus somewhat. Not my goal in life to be involved with kashrus. I was a Rebbe in Yeshiva Nei Yisrael, and my main thing is teaching Torah. But sometimes when there's a vacuum and no one's taking care of it, so then the situation actually demands that someone should step in. So I got involved in kashrus at first in Baltimore, but it didn't take long to see that many of the products that are produced in Baltimore, which the caterers use, the bakers use, the butchers use, the ingredients do not originate in Baltimore. So if we have a caterer that wants to make he's making a roast meat, the meat could be kosher slaughtered in Uruguay or in Argentina, and then it's brought down to someplace, maybe New York, where it's kosher. Maybe it's kosher over there, and then finally it ends up in Baltimore. And if you want to give a kosher, so you've got to give it all the way down from the beginning. So that meant that I've been in many slaughterhouses in Chile, in Uruguay, in Argentina, certainly in the United States, in postal Iowa, and in Illinois. There's a big slaughterhouse near Chicago, and in various places all over the United States, in South Dakota, North Dakota, in Nebraska, all over, whether it be even in Alabama. These used to be a slaughterhouse, not there anymore. So it takes time. And along the way you pick up some information. We are involved now somewhat in Eretz Yisrael in giving hechsher. Now, it's not as if in Eretz Yisrael they need the sakei, which I respect, any rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. They have a whole kashrus system over there from the government, from the Ministry of Religion. They don't need us. But the people from the United States that go to Eretz Yisrael and they stay in a hotel and someone calls us, you eat in this hotel? How can you eat in this hotel? Don't you know that this and this rub says that you shouldn't eat in this hotel? So these kids get all confused and they don't know, can you not? Is this part of gas? Was it no? So actually it came from Eretz Yisrael, this request that since we are an American kosher certification, that we should be able to say yes, no. So people should have more faith in the kosher certifications which there are in Eretz Yisrael, which are actually good certifications. So this coming year is going to be the Shemitah year. So in the Shemitah year, the Minig in Yerushalayim is like the Parashat Shulchan. I'm not going to bother you with all the ramifications of the Parashat Shulchan. He was a Talmud of Chaim Volozhiner, if that means anything to you. And he said that if a non-Jew owns land in Eretz Yisrael, then the din of Shemitah does not apply to his land. And that if they cultivated grain, let's say a plant of wheat, and he harvested the wheat, the guy is not subject to the laws of Shemitah, then a Jew is allowed to eat this wheat. If a Jew went and cultivated wheat on his own land in Eretz Yisrael, it is forbidden. You're not to eat it. There are certain things which you'll have to eat, but you have to eat them with, like if it goes on a tree. If you worked on the tree, the food may be permitted, but you have to eat it. The Kedusha Shvi is the certain ways how to eat it. But things that grow from the ground that you have to plant every year, they are not permitted, even if they grow by themselves. They're paid. But grow by itself, it is permitted. And that's the minhag in Yerushalayim, that they go with this Torah view. So we went to one of the major distributors of fruits and vegetables in Yerushalayim, that distributes in Yerushalayim, and we went to him and we say, we've got this Shemitah problem coming up, and the next year we want you only to buy from non-Jews. So there's no problem, even though it's more expensive. Normally, whatever's produced by the Jewish people is more expensive than what the Arabs produce, because we would like to support the Jewish people. It's a normal thing. So the Arabs, you know, they only go if there's no, so their price goes down. But in the Shemitah year, the price of the Arab produce goes up, because they don't want that, and the ones that the Jews produce, there are people who don't keep Shemitah, their prices go down, and because they have difficulty sell to people, even though there are a lot of non-frum people in Eretz Yisrael, but since there are a lot of people don't want to use it, and the professional organizations, a lot of them don't want to use it. Now's the problem. You know that you're the one who's selling the fruits and vegetables is an honest person, and you check up on him, and you know that he only buys for non-Jews in the Shvitiyah. But the problem is that this non-Jew is a businessman. This Arab is a businessman. What he may do is buy produce from the Jews because it's cheaper. And he has his own produce that he also buys from the Jewish people, brings it at night, and then he comes and he delivers it from his field. So how do we stop this? All right, so what we did was we made an agreement, signed a contract with a company, a satellite company, that will take pictures of the whole area, all these fields, aerial pictures, every 5 minutes. So if any truck comes in, even in the middle of the night, because these satellites, they take pictures through the clouds, because it goes with the heat. And they will take them at night. It is a night vision they have, and every 5 minutes they'll take pictures of all these fields. And if anyone will come with a truck, you'll be able to tell. These pictures are so accurate that you can actually read the license plate on the car from 100 miles above the earth. They can read the license plate. So that's one thing that we've done. Well, you know, if you have this GPS system, they know where you are. They're up there in the sky, and they're tracking you all the time. And it's the same concept. It's expensive, but the only other way to do it is to have people flying over in helicopters all the time, which is not as reliable, and it's even more expensive. We have to have Goyim who fly on Shabbos and Goyim travel on the Goyim, and it's not, it doesn't work so well. This way is much, much more efficient. Let me speak a little bit about organic food. Now everyone knows that organic food is much healthier than regular food. And animals that have been fed only organic produce are much healthier than animals that are fed all this garbage, which you get from China, which is contaminated with all kinds of chemicals and may cause people to get sick and maybe even die. That's a known thing. So we had this company which produces organic beef, and they will not give them any chemicals to eat, and they will not give them antibiotics like this very common to give to these animals. And they're fed only the best food, animal food. So they wanted to produce this organic food as kosher, because they would open up the market for them. So we said to them, look, in order for you to figure out if it's worthwhile for you to do this or not, you should first you should have an idea about what percentage of kosher you're going to get. So we have only got kosher, and we said that in the East there's an animal called the back Angus cattle, and these back Angus come out the best as far as kosher goes, and we get about a third of them to be got kosher, and that means two thirds are not got kosher. So we said that with the organic, maybe you'll get 80%, maybe 90%, so you should figure out the profit that you think you can make, because the more high percentage of kosher that you have, the more money you'll get. So you'll see if it pays for you to do this. So we said, we're going to send down someone to your plant, it was in Colorado someplace, and we will not shech the animals. We will just search them, because the animal, you have to kosher slaughter it. And after you kosher slaughter it, you check the inside to make sure there's no adhesions on the inside, which would make it not kosher. We said, we'll just send out someone to check if there's any adhesions over there that make it not kosher. So you'll get an idea about what kind of profit you're going to make, and then we'll talk and work out all the rest of the details. They said, fine. So we sent out this Bodek, that's what he's called, one of the checks. And much to our surprise, we found out that it wasn't 90% kosher like we had anticipated, but it actually was 3% kosher. Why? These animals are sick animals, because they are organic. And they're not allowed to have any anything which is not natural. The livers were infested with pathogens, and we don't know how long they would live. You've got to hurry up and shut them before they die. So why is that? Because today the situation is so that you cannot raise cattle, healthy cattle, without using antibiotics. They actually do not live a normal life, the cattle which are raised in the United States. They are fed grain, corn. It is not the natural food for cattle. The natural food for cattle is grass. But the problem is that when you feed them grass, look, well, you have to have grass. This way you keep them in a pen and you put them in a trough and you just put them in the food. But if you give them grass, they will not gain weight fast. Till they get to maturity, are you familiar with this? You know this? You deal with cattle? Okay. It actually will take about 3-4 years until they get the weight that they normally sold at. This way they can do it in somewhere between 18 months and 18-20 months. They can get them to 1,800 pounds, that is usually the live weight of the cattle which they're sold. So in the United States, everything is money. The longer you keep them, the more you tie up your money, and you have to have people taking care of them, and it all costs money. So you want to do 1-2-3. So is this enough fed? If they'll be fed normal the way they're supposed to, they will be healthy. Matter of fact, in South America, the percentage of glut kosher is much higher, because they eat the grass-fed cattle. They're also, the meat is much tougher, because the cattle are free-roaming cattle, they run around. And in the United States, you don't want the animal to run around. As a matter of fact, there was an advertisement from the people who want to help cattle, animals, and they said, this animal, there's a picture of a calf, this animal has only 2 feet. And they were selling animals that had only 2 feet. So how do you do this? Because they put them into a stall that's only 2 feet wide. That's the 2 feet which they have. This animal only has 2 feet. And from the time it's born, until the time it goes to the slaughterhouse, it stays in this tutu. And it's in a dark, stable. And it's, and the reason why they don't want it to move is because if it moves, it's gonna use up calories, and then it won't gain weight. And not only that, but if it does move, it strengthens the muscles, and the meat gets tough. So we don't want that. So we just keep the animal. This animal has 2 feet, and that's how they sell. It is cruel, and that's what the housewife wants, because that's this white veal, and they won't take the red veal, because we begged the people, give us red veal, and we'll shech the red veal. And they say, look, we have customers, and we'll buy it. She said, but you only buy the forequarters. I've got to get rid of the hindquarters also. There's no way I can get rid of it. Okay, so the so these animals were sick animals. So the whole thing didn't pay anymore. I mean, they understood that they're not going to make any money this way. And so the whole project was abandoned. Now, this is in the meats. Now, in the vegetables, like in the cabbage, in the lettuce, in the spinach, in other broccoli, there are very often insects, thrips, and aphids, and we're not allowed to eat them. So there's a problem. How do you get rid of them? We gotta eat. So actually, the Starkey is working now on a camera that when you take a picture of the leaf of lettuce, let's say our main lettuce, where they're more prevalent than other lettuces, that it covers the whole spectrum of light, and it will be able to pick out the protein that's in the lettuce from the lettuce leaf, because the thrips and the aphids and other insects, they have protein in them. But the lettuce itself has no protein. And so therefore, if you can, so we're developing with, we made an agreement with a company that they should develop us a camera that will be able to pick it out. And once we have that camera, it will automatically, when it comes down the line, it'll knock out all those leaves that have this problem with it. Okay. So this was about 3/4 a year. They said, oh, no problem, we'll have it right away. You know, just give us $7,000 and we'll have it. Well, it's already 3/4 of a year, and they said they can do it, but it hasn't happened. So, now, but it's in the works. Now, that camera will not help to find worms in fish, because the fish is all protein. It can pick out the protein from the not protein. It can't pick out the ones, and there are worms in fish sometimes. But the worms in fish are usually bigger worms. There are sometimes very long worms you find in cod. They may be 2 inches long, and they are about an inch in thick. They're not little tiny things like you find in the broccoli and in the other types of vegetables. As a matter of fact, if the insects are so small that you cannot see them, they're kosher. You have to eat them. Like in cheese. How's cheese made? Cheese is cultured milk. You put in bacteria into the milk, and it makes cheese. So these bacteria, they walk around, and they're living, it's living organisms. But it doesn't matter. But if you eat cheese, you can get kosher cheese. So no one's worried about them, because you can only see them with a microscope. You can't see them with the naked eye. And anything you cannot see with a naked eye, from a halachic standpoint, from a Torah standpoint, does not exist. Why? The Rav Arishon is not trying to trick us when he says, I don't want you to get any bugs. And then you eat cheese and you say, ha, I caught you, you ate bugs. The Rav Arishon is not trying to trick us. The Rav Arishon gave us eyesight, and whatever we can see with our eyesight, we have to be worried about. Whatever we cannot see with our eyesight, the Rav Arishon does not hold us responsible for, even though we know it is there. The Torah didn't say it's there. I was at a meeting some weeks ago of Rosh Yeshivas in New York. that they were concerned that there's some bakeries in New York where they don't have a mashgiach there all the time, it just comes in once or twice a week, and they were concerned that how is it possible that it could be kosher if the mashgiach only comes in once or twice a week. Who knows what's going on when he's not there? It was not something that had to do with our kosher certification directly. It was not our kosher certification in general. I wasn't the only one there. There were other people in kosher there. So I said to these rabbanim, these Rosh Hashivas, I said to them, you know, what you're saying, I said, I understand what you're saying. We feel that if a person who is running this bakery is a someone who's dependable, reliable, especially if he's a Shalom Mitzvah, that we don't have to have a person stand there all the time. We just watch the ingredients that come in. If all the ingredients that come in are okay, so then we feel confident that it'll be all right. But I said, there's a much bigger problem, which you're not addressing, which we are addressing. He says, what is this problem? I said, let's say the oil that they use in the bakery. Where does it come from? It comes from Malaysia, Indonesia. How does it get? So we're using palm kernel oil, which is very commonly used in bakeries, even though it may be not so healthy, because it sets at room temperature. And if you want a cookie, the candle was made just with regular oil. You take the regular oil, it'll fall apart. But if you use this oil, which coagulates, becomes a piece at room temperature, so then the cookie will stay together. Very commonly used in bakeries. Now, I said it comes from over there, from the Orient. I said, how did it get here? It comes by boat. Now, these boats have holds. At the boat, maybe a quarter mile long, a half mile long. Big, huge boats. There are no cabins in these boats. They have holds. They're like big containers, which are part of the boat. Now, I was in one of them, and it's about 48 feet deep, and maybe another 40, 50 feet wide, maybe 100 feet long. And the whole boat is full of these containers. They maybe have 100 of them in there. So they pour this oil, they pump it into these holds, and then it comes from Malaysia, comes over here to America, to Port of Newark or New York or whatever, and here they pump it into storage facilities. This boat, how do you know what was in this hold the last time that this boat sailed, where it went? Maybe there was animal fat in it. And not only that, even if there was for sure no animal fat in it, maybe the next hold, where there's just one wall between the two, maybe that hold has animal fat in it. Now, and since it's all shipped hot, because if you have palm kernel oil and you let it cool off, you will never get it out of that boat. You're going to have to hire 100 people with a spade and try to get it out. It won't come out. The only way you can get it out is if it stays liquid and then you pump it out. So here you've got hot palm kernel oil, coconut oil. You have next hold, you may have hot animal fat or whale oil. And there's one wall between them. These are the problems that we're concerned with. Not with your mashgiach in the bakery, you know, where we think that this is not such a, it's not so crucial. It's more crucial to make sure that the product that comes in is kosher. And it doesn't end there. It doesn't end with the boat. After the boat has already been designated as kosher, we've already checked the manifest of the boat that for the last three times they only had kosher oil in this hold and in the adjoining hold. When it comes in, it gets pumped out and it goes into these big tanks at the terminal, And from there, it gets shipped either by rail or by truck to wherever it has to go to. Now, when it comes in, so they have these big vats. You start to see them, maybe 50, 100 of them. You can see them when you go on New Jersey Turnpike. And the and they have dedicated ones for each type of oil. So the ones used for a kosher type oil will always be used for a kosher oil. Ones used for non-kosher oil will always be used for a non-kosher oil. But there's one problem, and that is they also have to keep it heated. And how do they keep it heated? They have a heating system that there's a boiler, and there's a pipe that comes out of the boiler and goes through the first tank, and then it goes from there to the second tank, and from there to the third tank, and it goes all the way around. And then it goes back into the boiler again. So now the problem is that the water in this tank, even though it doesn't touch the oil, but it's like a the pipe itself, it's gonna become trace from the trace of oil in one of these tanks, and the water inside will become a trace, and then it'll go and make everything trace. So these are the problems that we have to deal with. So we deal with them. And the way we deal with it is that we put something into the water which will make the water not fit for consumption. There's certain things on the market which are sold for this purpose, like they have dangerous types of liquid they want to ensure no one eats it, so they put something bitter inside so no one should eat it. Bitrix school is one of the famous ones. And that way, whatever goes in from the trace into the pipe will become not fit to be eaten, and so therefore it is permitted. But whatever, if it goes there, if it goes from there, it goes by railroad truck. So now you've got to rail cars. You've got to make sure the rail cars are kosher. If it goes by truck, you have to make sure the truck is kosher. And we have truck washing stations that will kosher the trucks as necessary. And then I just want to tell you another secret before I go ahead and to a different topic. That some people make a mistake that the truck is made out of two parts. There's a cab in the front, and then there's a truck in the back, where you put in the whatever you want to put in. Now they're interchangeable. You take off the cab from one back of the truck and put on someone else. So, but the product only goes into the back of the truck. So therefore, the only thing you have to kasher is the back of the truck. But there's no way you're going to kasher in the front of the truck. No product goes there. It's just a cab. It's just the engine that pulls the back. Okay, everyone understands that, right? That's all wrong. It's not true. You've got to kasher the front of the truck, too. Why is that? Because there's a pump on the truck that, in case the facility that you go to doesn't have a pump, the truck has their own pump, and they'll pump it into their vats, what they have in this company that uses oil. Now, the pump of the truck is never attached to the back of the truck. It is only attached to the front of the truck. It wouldn't work if it was attached to the back of the truck. The motor is in the front of the truck. And this pump is attached to the motor. It comes off the motor. So it has to be in the front of the truck. So you have to cash out that front of the part in the cab in the front where the car will go through also. So there are these all kinds of things. We are familiar with all these things in the car. Anyone in the car industry knows about them because they are vital and crucial, that if they're not taken care of, the whole hachsher is not worth anything. Recently there's been some commotion about the coatings on fruits. Now, we've been tracking this coatings on fruit already for many years, but someone found out about it recently that they put coatings on fruit. Now, you know, any person who is a little bit observant can see that some fruits are coated, like, for instance, cucumbers. If you don't realize that cucumbers are coated, then evidently you never ate a cucumber, or at least the young and peeled. They coat them, so the wax, and sometimes a very thick wax, is on cucumbers. But every fruit is coated. Apples are coated with a type of shellac that you can't wash it off. You can scrape it off, but it'll take you about an hour to scrape it off an apple, but you cannot get it off. But even peaches, fuzzy peaches, are coated. All fruit is coated. Why? Why do they coat it? because in America, everything is money. America believes in money. The God of America is money. As a proof of that, on every piece of American currency, it says in God we trust. So let's say you're saying apples. Let's say you were selling apples. And apples very often are sold by the pound. Naturally, the water, which is in an apple is 87% water, the water in the apple will evaporate somewhat through the skin. It's normal. Now, if you have grapes and you evaporate the water, you get raisins. So, and if you have plums and you let the water evaporate, it becomes prunes. It automatically will, every fruit, the water will evaporate through the skin. When that happens, it loses weight. And if it loses weight, you lose money. Because what normally would have been, if the water vapor would not have been able to get out, would be 3 pounds of apples. Now it's only 3 quarter pounds of apples. So therefore, in order that it should, that they should retain its weight, they're coated. Everything's coated. Now, frankly, what is this coating made out of? The shellac is made by an insect, everyone knows that, but where makeup on it is not considered. You use it for the floor. This floor is shellac. Same shellac, exact same shellac. It's not considered sick to be eaten, and therefore, even though it's kind of an insect, it's okay. But there's other things in here, and we've been actually, we've been watching this already for maybe 30 years. Watching this to make sure that the formula, which we saw initially, where there was, which was kosher, they should stay the same way. In England, they made a new coating, which is actually made from Hausa fat, from tallow, and it is better than the one used in the United States. It is cheaper than the one used in the United States, and it tastes better than the one used in the United States. And there was a big push to import it into the United States, but the United States government protects its citizens and its businesses, and they made a law in order to protect the United States business that if you coat it with this coating, which comes from England, you have to write either on the fruit or put a sign next to the fruit that this fruit has been coated. Now, no one's going to eat coated fruit. That's simple. So therefore, they don't use one from England because they won't have to put up that sign. So they use one from the United States. If the United States is coded by the United States product, you don't have to put the sign next to it. Okay. Let me speak a little bit about Shabbos appliances. The use of appliances on Shabbos. We never had any problems. We had an oven on Shabbos. There were no problems with this oven. You put it on before Shabbos, you put a blech on top of it, and the blech covers the controls. You put on the food before Shabbos, put it on after Shabbos, put things in the oven, put things out on. There was never any problems. Now, in order to make the product better, the manufacturers have caused a lot of halachic problems with these ovens. The first problem that was very noticeable was that there's a safety feature in these ovens that if by mistake you left on the oven and then you're on the plane to Eretz Israel and then you say, hey, I forgot to turn off my oven. Don't worry, it goes off automatically after 12 hours. That's the first safety feature they put in. Well, that wasn't very good for people who wanted to eat chomps and put it in the oven for Shabbos morning, because even when Shabbos is late and it's first skier at 8:30 and you put it in, you put it on the lifts at 8:30 and I don't know what it is over here in this part of the country, but if you put in the chomps at 8:30 in the oven, it's going to go off automatically at 8:30 on Shabbos morning. So unless you get up to Hashkama Minyan, you're going to the next Minyan. So what time you want to eat it at 11:30, 12, it's going to be cold. So that was the first problem. The other features which they put into the new ovens is that they have when you open up the door, the light goes on. When you close the door, the light goes off. So you couldn't even open up the door on Shabbos because you're going to cause the light to go on. So that was another problem. Now in the refrigerator, you also have that problem. You couldn't just screw out the bulb. But in an oven, you can't just screw out the bulb because the bulb, in order to not be hit by this intense heat of the oven, so it's protected, and you have to be a mechanic, you've got to have mechanics to set the tools in order to get to this bulb. It's not for a regular person. So and if you want to, if there's a button on the bottom that gets pushed in and you put a piece of tape over the button, as soon as you put it on the oven, the tape is burnt up and there's no, forget about it. So it's a problem. Another problem which they had was that there's a display on the back of the oven, or on top of the oven, that tells you what temperature is in the oven. As soon as you open up the oven, it goes from 300 to 90 to 80 to 70 to 60. You're doing that by opening up the door. So there's another problem. The fourth problem is that some of these have a time bake feature. That means you can set the oven that it'll, let's say, for Friday night, everything will be piping hot Friday night, and then at 11 o'clock on Friday night, the oven will go off by itself, or wherever you set it to go off. Okay, so that's not the problem. It goes off by itself. You didn't do anything on Shabbos. The problem was that when the oven goes off, there was a buzzer that went off to let you know that the oven goes off. And the buzzer buzzed and buzzed and buzzed and buzzed until much of Shabbos. So people got fed up with this. So the company actually, people complained to the company. The company came to us and they asked, like, what can we do about all this? So what we did with these ovens was basically we made it into an old-fashioned oven. There's a Sabbath mode button, you press the Sabbath mode button, you hold it down for 5 seconds, and all of a sudden it says on the display Sabbath mode, and then when you open up the oven door, there's no readout, there's no temperature readout, it's bottle, nothing changes when you open it or not. If you put it in Sabbath mode when the door of the oven is open, the light will stay on the whole Shabbos. If you put it in Sabbath mode when the oven is closed, it will stay off the whole Shabbos, no matter whether you open it or whether you close it. The 12-hour safety feature that goes off has been extended to 72 hours safety feature because in case there's 2 days Yom Tov for the Shabbos, so 72 hours took care of that. And the buzzer either doesn't go off at all or just buzzes for 2 seconds and then it stops. So basically we put it back to where it was before. That's really what we did over here. So now we deal with it like we always deal with the oven. So we were very upset in the Starkey office. I was very upset and so were our people when someone called up to Starkey and said, "I want to thank you, rabbis. Finally you figured out a way how to cook on Shabbos." They thought it was a Sabbath mode, that means they can put food into the oven on Shabbos and cook on Shabbos. So that was very distressing. But we have definite instructions together with this, and it's in the manual. It's in the manual that comes with the oven, and it's on our website, the exact instructions of how to use it. Now, that was all. So as oven goes. But your refrigerators was no problem. I said you screwed the loose the bulb in the refrigerator and the light will not go on when you open it. It'll be all the same. As a matter of fact, some freezers, when you open up the door, the fan goes off in some freezers. So you had to make sure that there's a button, to make sure the button stays depressed, that you put a tape on it, whichever way you want to do it. Otherwise, you cannot open on shops. That was in the good old days. Now, there's something new about refrigerators, which is going to creep up on us, and no one's really going to know about it. That's what I'm telling you. every refrigerator has a heater in it. In the walls of the refrigerator, there's a heater. What's the purpose of this heater? That if there wouldn't be a heater, then the coils, the cooling coils, will frost over. And if they frost over, it won't be effective anymore. So in the past, what they had was that let's say, every 8 hours, the heater went on for 10 minutes and melted all the frost off the cooling coils, and then it went back to normal. There was no shiner involved over here, because whether you opened the refrigerator or you didn't open the refrigerator, every 8 hours it went off at 10, 20 minutes, whatever it was, whatever the company had said it, and you had nothing to do with it. On old refrigerators, sometimes you could feel they're hot on the outside, because the insulation has worn out somewhat, and you can feel the heat. You actually can feel the heat. Yes, now, in order to conserve energy, because now they have to put a stick on the outside of every appliance to say how much energy it uses per year, how much. So they want to minimize the cost of this heater, because actually it doesn't make any sense to say that every 8 hours we should put on the heater for 20 minutes. Because it depends. If you open up the refrigerator, so the air from the room went inside, and the number one, it works harder, and number two, it's the water vapor gets the coils more, because the regular air has water vapor in it, more than the one in the refrigerator. So if you don't open up a whole night, you don't need in 8 hours that it's gone for 20 minutes. Maybe in 16 hours it's gone for 20 minutes. If you open up many times during the day, you're using the compressor more, and it's going to make more frost, and therefore it should be more than 20 minutes and 8 hours. So it doesn't make any sense to do this. Now, there's a new thing. There's two ways now how to go. One of them goes that it goes on compressor time. That after the compressor has worked, so let's say 4 hours, then the heater will go on for 20 minutes. And some of them, depends how many times you open the door. But if you open the door, let's say every 40 times you open up the door, or 30 times, so then the heater will go on. Now we're going to be a big problem, because it could be when you're opening up the door, you're putting on the heater. Now, even though that on every refrigerator, we do have a question that when you open the refrigerator, hot air goes in the refrigerator, cold air comes out of the refrigerator, and you're causing the refrigerator to work harder than if you didn't open it up. We are MACO. So many of us are MACO that we are allowed to do that, because causing the refrigerator to work harder is also a rabbanon, and it's a grammar, and it's a doshe nacham. We found a heter for that. But that's not a heter for making a fire. And this is the heating coils is making a fire. You're turning on the gas stove. I mean, not the gas stove, the electric stove. You're turning it on. So this is a completely different. So now, once we became aware of this, we have negotiated with certain companies that if you put it in the south mode, this refrigerator, that it will work back on the old system. So there are a lot of things which are going on. We have an oven, an unbelievable oven, I must tell you this. It's called AGA. You're not going to buy it. It costs $15,000. But it is an unbelievable oven. The oven has four compartments. One compartment is 200 degrees. One compartment is 250 degrees. One compartment is 300 degrees. One is 350. It is heated by a single flame. One flame about this high, like a candle flame. And it's so well insulated that it keeps in the heat, and there's pipes going from this candle flame to these compartments, one's a bigger pipe and a smaller pipe, and it'll keep it at this amount of degrees 365 days a year. There are no controls. There's nothing to control it here. You want to bake it at 250, you put it in the 250 compartment. And actually, since it's so well insulated, it actually does save money on you don't make it back in $15,000, you have to wait 100 years to make it back. But it's It's an ingenious idea. And because of that, you'd be allowed to leave this on Shabbos, and you don't need any brach, because the same way the water urn, the hot water urn, you don't need a brach on a hot water urn. It's electric. You can't. There's no controls. The whole thing why you need the brach is that you shouldn't turn it, you shouldn't manipulate the controls. There are no controls on a hot water urn. There are no controls in the oven. It just works like that. So, if you're interested in spending $15,000, you might consider this oven. Okay, a new problem. It's a problem for cautious organizations. It automatically becomes a problem for you too. Propylene glycol. Have you ever heard of propylene glycol? It's in a lot of foods. It was never a problem. It was made from delicious petroleum. Crude oil, you distill it according to, and it's a byproduct of making gasoline. So you have this problem. It was never a problem. Now Dow Chemical figured out a way how to make propylene glycol from glycerin. So now it's not going to happen tomorrow, but we have to be on the alert now to make sure that all the propylene glycol that would be used in Pepsi Cola and the other food that you have, that it should be made only from a kosher propylene glycol. Alright, let me leave you one last thought. It's going to work. You know, there's such a thing in Jewish law that if a guy cooks food for you, if he cooks a steak for you, you're not allowed to eat it. Bishul Akum. A guy made it, you're not allowed to cook. If you put it on the fire, the Jew puts it on the fire, and the guy goes and he uses that fire to cook the steak for you, to roast it, whatever you do with it, so then our customers can be made home. So it tends to have a pilot light. So the heat is on the pilot light. The chances are the pilot light is in the area which is going to be heated up. If you do put it on, the guy can go like normal and cook up the meat. This often doesn't apply to everything. I just want to say that to me. It only applies to foods that cannot be eaten raw and to foods which are prestigious foods that a president would serve that is at his table when he has guests from different countries. But there are a lot of foods which have this problem of Bishul Akum. So of course, it has Akum. So then they make sure there's Mashgiach there to put on the fire. Now sometimes it has become increasingly... Sometimes we have a pilot light in. And we don't use the pilot light. You don't use the pilot light. Just put a pilot light into the oven. And then the pilot light is lit by two, and then what the guy is, even if it's an electric oven, it doesn't make any difference. There's a 5 foot rule. Now, some places, they don't allow pilot lights anymore. It's becoming extinct. It's like the American bald eagle. It's becoming extinct. So, like, a lot of efforts being put in to make sure that it doesn't become extinct, Chas v'Shalom, American bald eagle, will become extinct. It's on the flag of the United States. It's on the flagpole, and it's on the dial bill, and Chas v'Shalom become extinct, whole America might fall apart. So they're making a lot of effort to make sure that it stays where it is. But this is dangerous. These pilot lights are dangerous. Do you know that in a place that makes flour, and the flour dust in the air, if there's a flame introduced into this place, it can explode, and the whole place can explode because of flour dust. So in places, the bakeries that they use flour, there must be flour dust, they have a mixer, and they're not allowed anymore. The insurance companies don't allow it. You're not allowed to have any pilot lights. So everything goes with electric ignition, and even the stoves. You can't get a stove, try and buy a stove that works with a pilot light. You cannot get it. If you want to get it, the only place to get it is in Brazil. Go to Brazil, order from Brazil. It's made in America by Whirlpool. They ship it to Brazil, and then you can order from Brazil. You can't get it in America. So they're not there. someone invented something very interesting. There's a contraption in the oven, which it's lit electrically. There's an electric spark, and that will light up the oven. That lights up the oven if it's gas. Or if it's an electric oven. You can put a switch that the Mashgiach, who is in Atlanta, will be able to light the oven in Wyoming. You just dial the number on your phone, and automatically it'll switch it on over there, any place in the United States. And that is lit by a yeast. The yeast oven is lit. So that's available. There are a lot of things, you know, today we're living in the 21st century, and there are a lot of new things in all fields of Jewish life. In Shatness, there used to be a time, I mean, the Shatness only, I still might talk, if you were in the kitchen, right? Don't talk about the kitchen. That my father, Olah Shalom, was a chemist. And Rabbi Rosenberger, who was the head of the Shatness Laboratory, the first original Shatness Laboratory in the United States, in New York, in the Brooklyn and Lee Avenue, he asked my father if my father would be able to develop a test that you can tell if there's linen in the material or not. So my father made it for him, and it was a liquid, and you put it on the material. If it turned a certain color, it meant there was linen. If it didn't turn that color, so then it was a sign of no linen. Okay, so it was, he made it much easier on chance testing instead of having to break get samples and look at a microscope. You just put a drop of chemical on it and it would put it right away. Those things are gone forever. Today, like in the collar, behind the collar in a man's suit, there's a piece of fabric which is usually stiff, which gives a stiffness to the collar. Now, it used to be either it was made of linen or it was made of canvas. Today, they have them made out of canvas where every tenth thread is made out of linen. They have today threads to sew on the buttons, so either it's out of linen or it's out of cotton. Today, they have threads that are made where the core is linen and the outside is polyester or cotton, or vice versa. So today, you put the drop on the canvas, but if you didn't put it on the right, on that tenth thread, you won't find it. And even if you put on the tenth thread, if the outside is cotton, you won't see it either, because the inside may glint. So everything's become much more complicated. So of course, the Rosh Hashanah helps, so whenever things become more complicated, the solutions to it, I'm not going to bother you with all the solutions, but I'm just telling you that there's a lot of work, and we are using all the modern technology that is available at our disposal to protect your kashrus and to make sure that whatever you eat is 100% kosher. I just want to end to say again that I'm here for Yad L'Achim. They do wonderful things. The people in Mosa Nefesh, what they do, and if you support them, you're doing a very big mitzvah, helping them and helping yourselves. Thank you, and have a good night. Yeah.